Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this very special episode with Saifedean Ammous is brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans, enabling users to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell your existing holdings. Already a Ledin client? Ledin wants you to get more for referring friends and family. So as of December 1st, they're increasing their referral bonus to $50 USDC for the rest of the year. That means you'll now get $50 in USDC every time your unique referral link is used to open and fund a Ledin savings account. Since they wanted to make this a win-win, both you and your referral will also receive $50 in USDC. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast also get $50 in free USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our code. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. The Bitcoin 2022 conference, which celebrates Bitcoin over 4 days, April 6th to 9th next year, keeps adding more and more fresh and dope speakers, including Jeff Booth, Vijay Boyapati, Greg Foss, and now President Bukele of El Salvador. Known for being the first world leader to embrace Bitcoin and championing the recognition of Bitcoin as legal tender in El Salvador, Bukele will share the experiences and challenges of implementing this groundbreaking vision. Jeff Booth was on episode 27, Greg Foss was on episode 49, and Vijay Boyapati is scheduled to come back in a few weeks to talk about the greatest issues that humanity faces. Ticket prices go up in 7 days, so get in early and use our code BitcoinMatrix at checkout for 10% off your tickets. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Saifedean Ammous, where we talk about how the fiat standard has subverted the natural way in which the world works for every living creature except for fiat man.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Saifedean Ammous is a world-renowned economist and author. His latest book, The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization, is a tour de force. His prior masterpiece, The Bitcoin Standard, The Decentralized Alternative to Central Banking, is a definitive book on Bitcoin and has been translated into over 25 languages. He is also the author of the forthcoming textbook, Principles of Economics. Saifedean teaches courses on the economics of Bitcoin and economics in the Austrian school tradition on his online learning platform, saifedean.com, and Saif also hosts the Bitcoin Standard podcast. Saifedean Ammous, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm very good.
Yeah, it's a real honor to have this discussion with you. Your work has been immensely impactful on my life. I can honestly say that I'm not sure I'd be sitting where I am today if I hadn't read the Bitcoin Standard. It was very influential to me. I do think of it as the standard piece on Bitcoin. I grew up playing soccer. You might call it football, but my love of soccer, I remember as a little kid, I would carry a soccer ball around with me everywhere. I just wanted to understand the ball in every environment and get to know this object and master it. And that's how I felt about your book for, until this day. And
I grew up playing soccer a lot as well, too.
Yeah. So I kind of looked through a lot of future work on Bitcoin through the prism of this book, and it introduced a lot of ideas to me that were brand new or that I hadn't thought about in that way. And your writing is extremely clear and concise. I do feel like I'm reading the definitive piece, sort of a graduate level economics textbook on the subject matter. So I just want to thank you for that. I really appreciate it. What has been the reaction to you for the Bitcoin Standard, the book?
I have to say, overwhelmingly positive and surprisingly positive. I did not expect this to be the case when I wrote the book. I thought it would be more confined to academic circles, and given that it's a long academic book, it's not going to be very popular. I was surprised at how popular it was, and at just how many people told me that it was extremely important and life-changing for them. And I think it was a very powerful lesson for me to sometimes, or most people, and me before I wrote the Bitcoin Standard, you spend your life focusing perhaps on how do you make things so that they can be appealing to people. Whereas with writing the Bitcoin Standard, it was a lot more about me just saying what I wanted to say. And I wasn't focused on making it appealing, and I wasn't focused on trying to dumb it down or trying to gain a bigger audience. But it ended up doing just that. I was quite surprised at the kind of reaction that I got. I mean, it's been translated to about 30 languages now, and it's quite astounding. I've had people from all over the world, people who have gone through hyperinflation in Venezuela, who tell me that this book is the reason why I did well, why I could save myself and get out of Venezuela, or in Lebanon as well, where I used to live. A lot of people said the same thing. And then all the way up to people in, billionaires who bought the book and really liked it and bought a lot more Bitcoin because of it. So it's been quite surreal, to be honest. It's not something that I had expected, but I'm not complaining.
Yeah, that's great. Some of the ideas in the Bitcoin Standard, do you think like the ideas around fiat life and sort of, you did talk about it in the Bitcoin Standard, like art. Do you think those ideas came to you during the writing of the book, or even maybe did you have those ideas about fiat and what how it was impacting art and music even before Bitcoin?
No, I had these ideas before Bitcoin, and Bitcoin kind of came in as a piece in the puzzle. In fact, big chunks of the book, well, not big chunks, but significant chunks of the book, the main ideas of the book when it comes to monetary hardness and hard money, a lot of that stuff, maybe not the historical stuff about the ancient monies, but about government monies and about the great supply growth rate of government monies. A lot of that stuff I had actually written initially in Arabic for a report for I was commissioned to write this as part of a United Nations agency who wanted me to write something, but they were extremely, it's a United Nations agency, and they were extremely unimpressed with it, and then they didn't even ask me to finish it. And so I'd had written something like 25,000 words, and it went nowhere, and I didn't publish it. And then I basically rewrote it in English and put it into this book. Because I mean, before I got into Bitcoin, and this was 2012, 2013, and I wasn't really much into Bitcoin at that time. And I was just, I had these ideas. And when you talk to people about these ideas from the context of gold, as a gold bug, their eyes just glaze over, or blaze over. I'm not sure what the expression is, but they just lose interest. It's a dead horse, and there's no point in whipping it. Gold bugs are always trying to talk about this stuff, and nobody really pays much attention to it. So it sounds like maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. People don't even care. But yeah, these ideas in terms of art, culture, time preference, and the link with money and the effect of going off the gold standard, I'd had these ideas before I'd even gotten into Bitcoin. And most influential for me was a book called Gold Wars, which is cited in the Bitcoin Standard, hugely influential. And that book was really, really massively influential for me in understanding these things. And of course, not just this one, but also a lot of the work of Austrian economists like Mises, Rothbard, and Guido Hultzmann. So I'd had these ideas. But then Bitcoin comes in, and initially I hear about Bitcoin and I don't take it seriously, and then it just continues to grow and it continues to refuse to die, and all of the scenarios in my mind, the usual ignorant no coiner perspectives on Bitcoin, which are born out of ignorance, which is it's gonna die, it's going to go to zero, it's all of these ideas. If you try and keep an open mind, if you're not a pig-headed idiot about it, they you have to admit that they crash against the shores of reality, and they just don't withstand scrutiny over time as Bitcoin continues to grow. So then I mean, for me, initially when I first heard about Bitcoin, I thought, you know, wouldn't it be neat if we really did have something that was digital that could do everything that gold is supposed to do, but wouldn't be stopped by government? It would be very neat, but obviously it won't work. But in my mind, from the first time that I heard about Bitcoin, it always fit into that niche, into that, you know, there was the Cinderella's glass slipper out there, and there was this ugly girl pretending to be Cinderella. I was going in there and like, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be a nice story if this dirty girl living with her mother-in-law and her ugly stepsisters, if she turned out to be Cinderella, but obviously she won't be. But day after day, you know, the glass slipper just keeps looking like it fits more and more. And eventually you come to terms with it. It is Cinderella. It does fit in there. And so the book came about as I was beginning to believe that, yeah, this is the Cinderella. It does fit into the glass slipper of the holy grail that I think the world needs, which is a hard money that governments can't inflate. It can get it can get government out of money, and it can stop governments from inflating the money supply. And it can bring us back to what I think of as, you know, the process of civilization, which fiat money subverts.
Yeah, I agree with you that, you know, we found the glass slipper, and it's interesting to note the story about Cinderella, you know. But when did you get the idea to write about the evil stepmother, the fiat standard?
I think, you know, the Bitcoin standard makes the case for why Bitcoin is the Cinderella, why the glass slipper fits. But then it leaves you with the question of, all right, well, what's the stepmother going to do about it? Because right. She's not just going to let Cinderella go and try the slipper and go marry the prince. She's obviously going to try and pass off her ugly daughters as the as the owners of the slipper. And it's a tricky question, which I obviously had no time to get into in the Bitcoin standard. The Bitcoin standard is already pretty dense, and I think I'd agree with you that it is kind of it is concise. Like, it's 300 pages, but it's still concise. I don't spend a lot of time dwelling on ideas. So that there's quite a lot of ideas packed into the Bitcoin standard, and there wasn't enough room to get into the question of how this will unfold. Okay, so this is why this is the best money. And in the end, I explained why it's hard for the stepmother to stop it. But then, all right, so what's going to happen? And that was really the focus of my writing after writing the Bitcoin standard. So I finished writing the Bitcoin standard in 2017. I published it in 2018. And then in 2018, I started writing essays for subscribers, which was basically the main questions that I was getting from people about what questions they were left with after the Bitcoin standard. So maybe the most common one is, all right, so how is this going to unfold? And so I started writing all these scenarios and thinking about how it could unfold and thinking about how it would interplay with fiat. And that, you know, you can't really answer that question unless you understand what fiat is and how fiat works. You can't really figure out what the stepmother is going to do until you figure out what her deal is. And so over time, I started thinking of fiat more and more. And I think the key point, which was like the kind of breakthrough insight that was the motivation for writing the whole book, was just grasping the idea that fiat money is debt. And so if fiat money is debt, then we've got an important consideration to keep in mind about how this thing is going to unfold, in that Bitcoin is different. Bitcoin is not debt. So with fiat, we're monetizing debt. With Bitcoin, we're monetizing a hard asset that is nobody's liability, that does not carry liability with it. And I thought that was really a very, very important point toward explaining how these things will unfold. And so I then decided the best way to tackle this would be to go ahead and approach fiat itself in the same way that I wrote about Bitcoin. So everybody thinks they understand fiat because, you know, they deal with fiat every day and they grew up in a world that is fiat full and they're constantly dealing with fiat. But I thought, you know, when I started writing the Bitcoin Standard, nobody or very few people understood Bitcoin or knew what Bitcoin was about. And so I decided I'm going to research it from scratch and write about it from scratch and explain it to somebody who has no idea what Bitcoin is. And I then decided, you know, maybe that's the right, and that worked really well. You know, a lot of people liked that book. So maybe that's the approach I should take with fiat. Just come at it from scratch, assume zero knowledge from the reader. Assume the reader is somebody, you know, maybe born 200 years from now who's never lived under fiat money and doesn't know what it is, or from an alien civilization or from an isolated tribe in the middle of some jungle somewhere. And you're trying to explain to them how this thing works. So start from scratch and explain how the mechanisms of it work. And then I think, just as with the Bitcoin Standard, if you explain the mechanism from scratch, you'll arrive at a decent way of understanding how this thing, you'll arrive at a very solid ground from which to make conclusions about how it'll unfold over time and how it'll evolve. And so this really, you know, explaining how fiat works, particularly with reference to the idea that fiat is the monetization of debt, is an extremely, extremely powerful analytical lens. And generally, it's not something that many people talk about. And when you do talk about it, well, when people do talk about it, it's generally idiot Marxists and MMT people and Keynesians and who talk about it from a positive perspective. That, you know, money should be debt. Money is debt, and that's a good thing. And that means we need to have the government and the central bank in charge of money creation because they have to be in charge of debt, because they are naturally the best and biggest borrowers. And so we need to, and so it's presented from a kind of perspective of government propaganda, basically. Let's think about the economics of that. You know, let's not be regime apologists. Let's not be regime propagandists about it. And think about the real implications of what happens if you're actually using government debt as money.
Yeah. What I found fascinating about the read at first, especially coming off the Bitcoin Standard, I was armed with more ideas. And I was really excited to get into this. Because like we were saying about in the Bitcoin Standard, you really do pack punches in short bursts in that book as well, where maybe you only spent maybe two pages on art, but I really wanted to dig deeper there. And what I thought was really interesting about the Fiat Standard is you came out really fair. You didn't come out scathing and punching in the beginning and trying to tear it down right away. You tried to explore and try to come at it from ground zero. So what was the never-ending bank holiday? And was that sort of the first implementation of fiat, of the fiat network?
Yeah, I think, you know, with Bitcoin, I started with the Bitcoin Standard. You know, the way that I started writing the book, if you look at it, it's almost written like a parody of the Bitcoin Standard, in a sense that it's a parody is the wrong word. I'd say imitation. It's almost like an imitation. So the cover is identical. I use the same fonts on the cover, the same drawings, the same pictures. You know, three pictures of the evolution of money from of evolution of the forms of money under the Bitcoin Standard, and then the evolution of forms of slavery under the fiat standards, from the whip and then the ball and chain and then the dollar bill. And then in the Bitcoin Standard, I started off with this, you know, the first story, the first chapter was when Satoshi Nakamoto wrote his email. So in my mind, giving myself a roadmap for writing the fiat standard was, let's just copy the Bitcoin Standard. Let's do the same thing that we did with the Bitcoin Standard. And this was kind of like the scaffolding of writing the book. Almost, it's what helped me buckle down, focus, and write the book out, was to just follow the guidelines of how I wrote the Bitcoin Standard. So I just had the Bitcoin Standard there. You know, I didn't have to think about what to do with the cover. I just copied the Bitcoin Standard cover. And so I didn't have to think about what to do with chapter one. I'm just going to do the same thing that I did with the Bitcoins then. And it's almost, it's kind of like an entrepreneurial decision, which is don't mess with success. The Bitcoin standard worked. People liked it. Let's do the same thing. So the first thing in the Bitcoin standard was Satoshi Nakamoto wrote the letter to the cryptography mailing list announcing the announcing Bitcoin. Well, what's the equivalent for that in the case of fiat? Let's dig deep. So you could suggest, many would argue, I'd say that, you know, the Nixon coming off the gold standard was the equivalent of that. But in reality, I don't think that's the case, because this was 50 years in the making, 55 years, 56 years in the making until we got to that point. This was really the mature implementation of fiat. This was like January 2009. But the beginning of the work on this new implementation, you know, the equivalent of the cryptography mailing list email was, I'd say, the World War One. That's when we really went off the gold standard. And in obviously in regime propaganda economics, they like to say that the US and the world went off the gold standard in 1971, because that way they get to blame everything that happened before 1971 on the gold standard, which is a very, very, very important sleight of hand. So basically, you know, the Great Depression was caused by the gold standard, if you listen to dumbass Keynesian economists. And then going off the gold standard was what allowed the world to recover from the Great Depression, which is complete nonsense. They'd gone off the gold standard in World War One. That's something that nobody really likes to talk about. Regime economists don't really discuss this. But what was really interesting is, A, this is not talked about historically, and also, a couple of very important documents came to light in the last 2 years, in the last 4 years, really, 2017, 2019. A bunch of very important documents came to light, which really cast a very, very revealing light on that period, particularly in England, which, you know, before World War One, the world was on a gold sterling standard, really. Gold standard, yes, the world was on a gold standard, but primarily that gold standard revolved around the Bank of England. And the banks, the Bank of England's sterling pound was considered as good as gold. And that really was the problem. Because their sterling was as good as gold, you know, they just started issuing more sterling and the world started treating it more and more as gold. And then that financed and allowed the British Empire to do all kinds of crazy and insane things all over the world with their magic money printer, because they could just basically print gold. And they could get away with it before World War One, because all of the, well, the majority of the world had to use their they had to use the Bank of England's clearing mechanisms. So the equivalent of what was a bank, what was a central bank in the colonies at that time was essentially a regional bank of the Bank of England. You know, if you had a central bank in the empire, it had to deal with the Bank of England, and they relied on the Bank of England very heavily. And so the Bank of England would keep their gold in London, would keep those colonies gold in London, and then would issue credit for them, and then it would settle their debts. And so it could get away with inflating the money supply quite a bit, and it could get away with but it could still get away with it while maintaining redemption. They could still tell people, you can come in, give us your paper pounds, and we'll give you gold. Even though they had more liabilities than they had physical gold, they could get away with it because everybody needed to rely on their clearance mechanisms. And then they really pushed that to the limit in World War One, where they effectively suspended redemption. And that's really, for me, when they went off the gold standard. Because as long as you're, I think the litmus test of whether you are on a gold standard or not is whether people can walk in with their gold, with their paper to your bank, and walk out with a gold coin, no question asked. And once that was suspended, which was 1915, and then you're really no longer on a gold standard. So I dig into some historical documents about how that happened, and I found it really absolutely fascinating. So the first very interesting story, which nobody really likes to talk about, which was only revealed a few years ago, is that when the when Britain went into World War One, they sought to finance the war effort by issuing bonds, but the British public was too smart to want to invest in this idiotic, pointless war in Central Europe, which really had nothing, for which England had nothing to gain. I mean, it wasn't even an empire war where, you know, we're going to get this giant piece of land and take their spices and their oil or their gold or their anything. You know, we're fighting, there are a bunch of inbred monarchies in Europe are fighting each other, and our monarchs are going to send people to go there and fight. Why do we care about what's going on between Serbia and Austria and Germany and Russia and all that stuff? So the majority of well, I don't know about the majority, but the English people did not buy enough of the bonds to finance the war effort. So what did the Bank of England do? The first kind of example of quantitative easing in history, they issued, they bought the bonds, they issued a bunch of money to buy the bonds, and they bought them under the name of two staff members of the Bank of England. So those guys went and bought the bonds for themselves. Apparently, you know, they were like private buyers of the bonds, but they were doing that with money that was given to them for the Bank of England, and they bought two-thirds of the issue. So I think it was £400 million, if I'm not mistaken. I may be off on the numbers, and only a third of these was sold, and the rest was bought by these two individuals. But then, of course, they covered that up, and they didn't announce that it was the two individuals who bought it. And they just said, and the Financial Times, you know, forever the shitcoin promoter of central bank shitcoins, the mouthpiece of central bank shitcoins, they wrote an article saying, you know, incredible success for the issue of these bonds. And that basically was the beginning of this historical mess that is fiat. Ever since then, it's just been lie after lie after lie and kicking the can down the road. And governments, particularly the British government, trying to cover its ass for making that lie. And it was only revealed recently that this was the case. The Financial Times issued a correction 101 years later. 2017, they issued a correction for this, or 103 years later, yeah, or maybe 102. But yeah, the Financial Times just recently issued the correction of it. And then there was the whole bank's diaries were released recently. A study that was commissioned in the 1920s by the chairman of the Bank of England. He had his secretary study the history of what the bank did during the war. And what the bank did, and this isn't mentioned, was that they told the British people, you know, from now on, you have to turn in your gold and we'll give you paper instead of it. And the post office will only make payments in, and the post office and the banks will only make payments in paper. And they will take all of your gold and give you paper instead of it. And we urge you to make all of your payments in paper. And that was it. That was how they went off gold, effectively. And they continued to inflate the money supply. And they shipped the gold off to the US, incidentally, so that they could get credit from American banks to fight the war. And so this is the ugly history of how fiat came about, and it's of course flies in the face of the ridiculous propaganda you hear from fiat shills and fiat apologists at universities and other central bank fronts, where you know, the 20 years later John Maynard Keynes comes up with a ridiculous story about, oh, no, actually, gold is bad for the economy, and what we really need is to have the government and the central bank print more money, and then that's better. And this was never presented as an idea coherently. This was the ugly lie that was this was the patently false lie that came in 20 years later, you know, during the World War and after the World War, the First World War. It was very clear that everybody was saying, you know, we're on a gold standard and we're going back to the gold standard, and we just need to suspend redeemability now because war and complications and so on. But nobody honestly could make the case with a straight face that going off the gold standard is a good thing. It was only after 20 years of going off the gold standard and the problems of the gold standard, and then they got this idiot Keynes to write this nonsense of his about to try and justify this decision as if it was good. And to today, we continue, you know, if you talk to your average PhD in economics, they have all these reasons for why actually, you know, gold is bad, then we need the money supply that increases in supply. But that's just the after the fact rationalization.
Yeah, I thought it was really insightful and helpful about the way you wrote the book was thinking through fiat in a series of implementations. And I kind of thought about that just in the sense that the world moved slower back then. So these implementations are not iterated every year or every 6 months like software is now. It took years and decades and generations to roll out these implementations. How does the network work in terms of like nodes and tokens? Are all nodes equal or all tokens created equally?
No, and this is really why I think the this framework was quite useful as a way of understanding how this thing works. Because if you draw an analogy with Bitcoin is software, so you know it's done by a software engineer. It doesn't carry with it emotional and political junk. It's not a relic that is being iterated upon politically. It's a software engineer who built it from scratch and built it to perform its functions. So it's designed like a computer, like a machine. And so it has all of the constituent elements of a monetary system. So if you draw analogy to it, you'll get a lot more clarity about the functioning of this relic of a system, which evolved through ugly politics and ugly compromises over time. So I think it was quite powerful to begin to just think about it from this regard. First of all, thinking of it, well, what is the equivalent of nodes? In Bitcoin, it's a decentralized network and there's tens of thousands of nodes, and anybody can run a node, and anybody can use it, and all the nodes are equal, and all the nodes are responsible for validating all the transactions. Well, in fiat, you really only have one full node in the modern fiat system, and that is the US Federal Reserve Bank. That's the one node that is able to decide which transactions are valid and which ones are not. They could confiscate your bank account today. You know, they could just decide that you did a bad thing, and because you did a bad thing, your money is no longer yours, and they can just take everything in it. They could stop any transaction that you've made, and they could they could cancel it. So it really does function like a node, and it operates like a node. And then you have the when you think about it in mining, and that's really the most powerful analytic point here, which is in Bitcoin, we know how Bitcoin is mined. I explained it in the Bitcoin standard. With gold, you know, you have to dig underground, and it's a very expensive process. But with fiat, you make new fiat, and the common misconception people have is that new money is made when it's printed, and that's not really true. It's only really true in examples when, you know, after the shit has hit the fan and things have gone really bad. So in reality, fiat money is created when when new money is printed. It's created when debt is issued. And then money is printed to turn some of that debt into physical form. So printing money is the equivalent, is kind of like the equivalent of making open dimes in the Bitcoin scenario. In Bitcoin, you know, you take some of the digital Bitcoin and you turn it into a physical Bitcoin when you make an open dime, or when Rodolfo makes an open dime. And that's kind of what the central bank's printing press does. But that's less than 10% of all money is digital in that sense, is physical. More than 90% of fiat money is digital money. And it gets created when new debt is issued. Either that debt is issued by governments when they borrow through issuing treasuries, or it's issued by private banks when they lend for any kind of business activity or consumer purchase. So when you go and borrow to buy a house, your bank is making new money. Your bank is mining money. is mining fiat. That's what lending is. When you take out a loan, they don't take $1 million. Let's say your house is $1 million. They don't take $1 million from their depositors and give you those $1 million. They make new $1 million every time you take out a loan.
Right. And that's kind of really frames it up in a different way. And what I really kind of got a lot out of the book too is around fiat balances. And how do we even run the numbers on this network? Can we run numbers
no.
in fiat?
There are no Pierre Rochards in fiat. We don't have the equivalent of a Pierre who could run the numbers and figure out what's going on. You have to basically tally up all the credit creation and destruction taking place all over the world, which is a very complicated ordeal, because it's you have to look at every balance sheet, and the value of the balance sheet is constantly changing depending on each business's conditions and each bank's conditions. And the fascinating thing about it is that because making new money happens when you issue debt, everybody has an incentive to get into debt. And so mm-hmm. fiat is quite remarkable in this regard, that other than Bitcoin and gold, the majority of people are in debt. And so I think the sum of fiat balances is negative. We have a negative amount of fiat in the world. Most people are in debt in fiat. So if you look at anybody's balance sheet, I mean, only the poor people are the ones who have positive balances. You know, if you're poor, you've got, a few $100 in cash, and that's all you own. Yeah, you have a positive balance of fiat. But if you're rich, you have $5,000 in your checking account, maybe, and maybe another $20,000 in a saving account. Maybe not, but then you don't have any other fiat. You've got $50 in cash, $5,000 in a bank account, and then you have a $1 million loan for your house and a $10 million loan for your business and a $200,000 loan for your sports car. And if you measure, you know, how much fiat do you actually own, your balance is negative. You owe fiat. And it's not like you owe it from somebody who holds that money. That's the thing. Like, it's not like, all right, I owe $5 million, then somebody somewhere has to have $5 million as a sum of money that is in their bank account because they took it from me, because I lent it to them. You're also in debt. Everybody else is in debt. So the money is constantly being created by borrowing, and everybody is constantly getting into bigger negative balances. So all these successful fiat players, if you play the game of fiat successfully, you play it by accumulating debt. And the richest people are the biggest borrowers. You know, the biggest borrowers in the world are the world's largest financial institutions. And the biggest borrower at all in the planet is the U.S. government.
Right. It's almost like the richest people are the most in debt and the biggest borrowers exactly. as well.
Exactly, and it makes sense when you understand it in terms of, I really think this was like an extremely revelatory moment for me when I started thinking about it this way. Yeah, that's why everybody is in debt. That's why the United States government is in so much debt, and it's been in debt for 60 years. The way this scorecard works is you need to be in debt. Like, it's a game. It's like a game of soccer where you need to concede goals in order to win. And so each team is trying to score as many goals in its own goal as it can.
Right. And these balances, I mean, with one full node, that they're not permanent. They're not irrevocable. And so, you know, and everyone's going into negative balance. That's what the system's designed for. And that kind of seems weird to run a whole ledger system around going into negative balance. What is fiat good for then? What are the killer apps of fiat?
So I have a whole chapter on that. I think, you know, the first and obvious one is that it's great for government financing. It allows governments to just finance itself infinitely, almost. As long as the currency works, the government can continue to borrow more, and the government can continue to spend more. And so clearly this is going to be popular with governments. Secondly, it's great for banks. Banks are the biggest borrowers. Banks are the masters of the running up a negative tab on fiat. They create fiat at all times. They want to always be borrowing. And so fiat effectively The birth of fiat around World War One was A, to finance war, but also B, it was to finance banks and to rescue banks from the recurring crises that they had because they resorted to fractional reserve banking. The correct free market mechanism of fixing fractional reserve banking was that everybody who engages in it goes bankrupt, and they either learn their lesson, or if they don't learn their lesson, at least they're broke and they can't try it again. That's how you build a healthy financial system. But the world took an insane turn because governments and banks could both benefit from this. So banks are, of course, extremely politically influential and economically influential, and governments are extremely powerful. And both of these parties could ally on, hey, you know, if we suspend gold and we stop using gold as money and we start using this negative scorecard as money, then we can do all the fractional reserve banking that we want. And you guys can finance all the war and destruction that you want, and we both win at the expense of everybody else. So those are the kind of the major ones. But I think there is, you know, to be fair, like trying to think about it from an engineering perspective, these were what made it politically powerful. But it does have one kind of engineering advantage over gold, which is what allowed it to succeed. I think initially is that it is faster to move around. So the main analytical framework of the Bitcoin standard was the concept of saleability across time. And so you compare gold and silver to other primitive monies, to Bitcoin and to government money, in terms of how well it holds onto its value over time. And the best metric is the increase in the supply. Or the stock to flow, the inverse of the stock to flow, because that shows how much the money supply increases and how much the money is likely to hold on to its value. Well, in the fiat standard, I think, you know, what gave fiat its monetary role, even though it has terrible saleability across time, is that it has good saleability across space. It's better than gold in that regard. So in that analysis, you know, looking at the birth of fiat, while the Bank of England was sending the country's gold across the Atlantic, I look at the cost of sending the gold, and it's pretty significant. It's somewhere in the range of about 0.1 to 0.5% of the cost of gold. And that's a lot. You know, if you're talking about large sums of gold, it's extremely expensive. And of course, it takes a lot of time. And also, as happened with one of those ships, the ship sank. It could happen that a ship could sink. And, you know, especially if there's a war going on, you've got enemies that are out there looking out for your ships that carry gold and looking to sink them. So one of these British ships was sunk with an enormous amount of gold. And it took a lot of cost and a lot of time to recover them. And they haven't recovered them all yet. So this is really, I think, the kind of limitation of gold that allowed fiat to take over. And the other thing is, the other way to understand this is, A, so the first is the cost of transportation, but B, the cost of transportation is not just important for its own sake. It's not like it's just a decision that's being taken in terms of, you know, let's save on costs by turning money into credit. It's that the incredibly expensive cost of transportation makes the alternatives to central banks not viable. And so governments in the fiat era, they did not need to go door to door putting guns to people's head in order to confiscate their gold. I mean, it happened in Russia and it happened in most communist regimes, but in most modern Western democracies, this was kind of done effortlessly and bloodlessly, because the money was already concentrated. The money had nowhere to go. The gold had nowhere to go outside of the banking system. Right. So if you wanted to keep your physical gold, yeah, you could use it to make payments to people in your immediate physical surroundings. But this was the beginning of the 20th century, and, you know, trade was extremely global. And you may not have traded with a lot of people abroad, but all the people you traded with people abroad. And so your physical gold wasn't very useful to them. You know, your local grocer got their groceries from the town next door, from the country next door, and from the continent next door. And for that, he needed banks. He couldn't send your gold coin to his suppliers in, you know, across the Atlantic. He had to use the banks. And so, you know, I'm sure a lot of people were not very happy about the idea of turning in their gold and taking pieces of paper instead of it in 1914. But we don't hear about those people because they couldn't do anything about it. They, you know, I'm sure some of them kept their gold, but it wasn't very useful. They still had to get paid and work with the papers because they could not build an alternative banking system. They could not build an alternative clearance system. They could not settle trades across the Atlantic with their gold coins because building gold banking is extremely expensive. And so all that governments had to do really was just make gold banking illegal, which is what they've done for more than a century now. You just can't have a bank built around gold anywhere in the world. Well, a century in England, but in other places it's a little bit shorter. But yeah, you can't have a bank around gold because it's really expensive to do it, and it requires physical centralization, and it requires, you know, a few small gold nodes, a small number of gold nodes, which are susceptible to being taken over by government. You know, people with guns can just come in and take your gold. So yeah, that really is the advantage that fiat has over gold. Gold's gold's extremely heavy weight and you know, physical nature makes it very difficult to means it doesn't have good salability across space.
Yeah, we've never had such, I guess, centralization of any human tool before, like we've seen with money now, or gold at least, and fiat. What, you know, how does fiat go against our very nature?
Well, I'm not so sure if it's the only thing that's centralized, but I think, well, I know, I guess you're right. It is the only way that it is centralized, but it goes against nature, and that's kind of the main topic of the second part of the book. You know, once we've established the kind of engineering perspective on how fiat works, the second part examines the consequences of, all right, what happens if we, because most people so far, our understanding of money is still stuck in the gold period. In fact, if you ask, I don't know what percentage, but a very large percentage of people still think their currency is backed by gold. They still think the, you know, this piece of paper is only a money because there's gold in the central bank. And even people who don't think that still think of the money itself as being the money. You know, they think that many of them think that the physical piece of paper is money, and that what the bank does is that they take your bank note. You know, you go and you deposit money, and then I go and I borrow money from the bank. They take the money that you deposited and they give it to me. And even some of them who realize that that's not the case, they realize, all right, well, no, the money is being created by the bank, and the bank and the central banks are printing money out of thin air. They still haven't really internalized the idea that it's debt that's being created, and that creating debt is creating money. And they haven't really thought of this kind of startling realization of that money is debt, and so everybody wants to get into debt, and everybody wants to have a negative balance, and that the way to win at the fiat game is to get into debt. Now, once you start thinking about that, the world starts to make a lot of sense. So first of all, everybody wants to get into debt. Everybody is in debt all the time. It's up to their eyeball in debt. And, you know, individuals are in debt, corporations are in debt, local governments and municipalities are in debt, national governments are in debt. Everybody is in debt. Large multinational corporations, they issue enormous amounts of bonds. The more successful you are, the more debt you issue. So that begins to make sense. And then secondly, when you think about it in terms of governments, because, oh, and the key thing is, you know, it's, if I borrow $100 from you, you're not creating new money. It's only entities that have a license to lend from the central bank that are able to create new money, because you can just mark a new entry on your balance sheet. If you were a bank, like if I borrowed it from you, you have to take $100 out of your pocket and give them to me, and now you don't have those $100. But if you were a bank, licensed by the Federal Reserve or your local central bank, then you don't have to take $100 anywhere in order to give it to me. You don't have an opportunity cost to lending. You just make money out of thin air, and you mark it on your account. And as long as the government lets you continue to lend, then you are able to continue to make money, to mine fiat. So that means that being on the good side of government allows you to basically have a cheat code to the economic game. And that's a term I should have probably used in the book. But that's, yeah, that's what it is. It's just cheat code for the economy. You know how in like video games, there's this cheat code, like in Doom, you could press IDDQD and then you gain, what was it, invincibility. So the bullets come at you and they don't hurt you anymore. Well, with fiat, a lending license from the central bank is like that. You get that and then you just keep handing out money and you don't face any restrictions. And if you do face a liquidity crisis, then the central bank steps in and gives you interest rates at a lower, gives you more loans at a lower interest rate to allow you to continue to operate. And, you know, this has basically been the business model of the banking sector for the past 30 years, which is just issue more loans until we get into trouble and then cry. And then the central bank comes and rescues you. Right. So we've suspended the rules of economics. We've suspended what, how an economy actually works. And it's truly devastating when you think about the impacts of it. And I think, you know, the only reason it hasn't, I mean, it has been obviously devastating. We've had two world wars. We have a lot of suffering and struggles and a lot of bad things happening all over the world. We have a lot of very bad people who have a lot of money and power and influence. But the reason it has not been as devastating as it could be, I think, is because of the technological advancements that we've achieved under the gold standard, which continue to allow us to operate in a much better way, but which we are destroying thanks to fiat, as I discuss a little bit later. But yeah, the natural way in which the world works is that everybody has to work in order to eat. You know, every animal has to hunt before it can eat. It has to work hard. You know, the ant wakes up and spends its entire day looking for food so that it can survive. And the same is true for the lion. The same is true for every living creature. Everybody except fiat man, you know, except some humans in the 20th century, they've broken this natural order of life, where they've just figured out that you don't have to work, you don't have to do anything of value for others. In a market, everybody has to do this. You know, the market is just the living embodiment of this in a human society, in a more civilized way, where you need to go and serve others in order to be able to eat. Yeah, there's no way around it. You have to either grow your own food or do something and give it to people who grow food or make the things that you want to buy. So you have to serve, you have to produce in order to consume. Fiat has subverted that to the point where a lot of people, probably the majority of people today, don't believe this, don't even know it. They don't think this is the case. If you look at your average politician, they don't think that you need to produce in order to consume. Mm-hmm. They think consumption is something that is granted by politics. You know, you just need to vote for the right people and then they'll give you the right amounts of candy that you deserve because you're special and you exist. This insanity only exists because we have fiat, because we have this ability of the government to decide who gets to create money and who doesn't. And therefore, they decide who has to work to eat and who doesn't. And we have a world in which a lot of people get to eat without having to work because they are close to the debt printer. Some would say, you know, the money printer, but I think it's more accurate to say it's not the money printer, it's the debt generation. That's really the trick.
Yeah, and what's wild there, I mean, about the debt printer and debt generation, I mean, when I read the Bitcoin standard, I got armed with all these new sort of economic ideas, and you touched on things about art and sort of disposability or disposable music and disposable art, and things are just made cheaper and faster and not meant to last as long. But what really struck me about the fiat standard was disposable lives and disposable families. So if you're someone in your 20s, maybe you've just taken on a lot of debt because you just went to college or university, but now it's hard to start a family. And at first, and I see that happening all around me, but I didn't necessarily think about that as deeply as an economic issue. And now, you know, after reading the book, you know, you see the impact of inflation on families, but on the people before they have families. I mean, they're already saddled with debt from education. Home prices are too expensive. They can't really, it's hard to think about starting a family. And how has fiat impacted architecture and like really sort of like what I'm getting here is like housing. residential housing? Has it made housing cheaper?
I think it's not necessarily that it made it cheaper. I think we still spend a lot of money on housing, but I think it's what has happened is that it has made it less long lasting. It has made it more disposable. I think there are two main implications of the use of fiat money, which animate and inform the second section of the book, which is fiat life. And the first is the fact that you have this ability of governments to just basically subvert the natural order of life, as I was saying earlier, by the creating money. And then the second one is that fiat is not hard money. So the hardness of money has declined. You know, by the end of the 19th century, the whole world has a form of money that whose supply increased at around 2% per year. So everybody in the world could invest, could save their labor, the value of their labor, in a form of money that nobody could make more than 2% of. And so everybody could be more or less sure that if you just buy some gold, or if you earn some gold, stick it under your mattress, wait a few years, no matter how long you wait, that nobody's going to be able to find new gold printer that's going to devalue that. And so you always had a way of providing for your future self. And you always had a way of securing your future, because you could just put your gold coin under the mattress, under the floorboards, and future you could always dig it out when they needed it and they'd have it. And then the 20th century comes along and it takes that away from us. It takes away from us the ability to provide for our future self. And I think this is a very, very powerful explanatory factor. A lot of people have written about time preference and about money and inflation, but I don't think many or any really have drawn the connections as directly. But I think it's very true. If your money is increasing, you know, it used to be increasing in supply at 2%, but then we moved to fiat, and I calculate that in the last 60 years, the average fiat currency or total fiat currency supply increases at around 14% per year. So you go from 2% to 14%. Well, 14% means you lose 50% in 5 years. So if you put that fiat, your average fiat paper, you put it under your mattress or under the floorboard, and you wait 5 years, it's lost half of its value. It can buy you half of what it could buy you when you put it there. So let's say you have enough money to buy a house, but you don't want to buy a house now. So you put the money under your floorboard. 5 years later, that money will buy you half the house that you wanted. So what that means is that our ability to provide for the future is massively compromised, and that just makes the future more uncertain. And as the future is more uncertain, we discount the future heavier. And I think this is an extremely powerful way of understanding all the bad things, or many of the bad things that have happened in the 20th century. People's time preference has risen. And this is really the reversal of the process of civilization. And that's why the subtitle of the book is not really just hyperbole. It really is an alternative to human civilization. Fiat is a way of just getting everybody to become a debt slave with no potential for thinking for the future, and therefore little prospect for civilization, little prospect for investing in the future, for wanting to provide for the world, wanting to provide a better life for the world, for your future self. And so everybody's just constantly becoming more and more high time preference, becoming more and more present oriented. And so you see this reflected in families, you see it reflecting in people, you know, they spend their youth playing around and enjoying essentially eternal adolescence, because it isn't as pressing to provide for your future, because A, you don't have a very reliable way of providing for your future, and B, the reason you don't have a way of reliably providing for your future is because your money is screwed, and the reason your money is screwed is that the government is able to take your money, so therefore the government can provide for you for your future. So instead of working for your own future, you know, instead of investing in your own family, you just go and do what all 20th century people do, which is vote harder. And you think that, you know, if I just vote harder, then my government is going to give me all the things that I want. And then, you know, most people in their old age, they realize, oh, wait, you know, even if the government can give me money to keep me alive in my old age, can't give me children, it can't give me a companion, it can't give me a family to care for me and love me and caress me. And it's just, it's a tragic example of how our high time preference just screws us over. And I think architecture is another reflection of that. It used to be that when you built a house, you built it and it stayed built. You know, you built a house to last you a lifetime and last your kids a lifetime and their kids. You look at 19th century architecture. 19th century buildings survive better than 1960s buildings. So the example that I use is the Boston Public Library. Their first building, the McKim Building, was built in 1890, I think. It's probably the most beautiful building in all of Boston until today. It's an amazing building. The interior and exterior are gorgeous. Gets a lot of tourists who go there. And then you get the McKim Building, which was built in 1971. And it looks like a box, like a shoebox, like all these other buildings. And it's nicknamed the mausoleum because it looks like a giant grave. And by 2010, it needed a massive renovation that cost, in dollar terms, the renovation of the McKim Building in 2010, I can't remember if it was exactly 2010, but it was around that time, the renovation of the Johnson Building, the new one, the renovation of the new modernist abomination cost as much as the building of the old McKim Building, the original building. So in 1890, for $2 million, which is $70 million in modern dollars, you could build this masterpiece, which has survived now for 130 years and has not required massive restoration or renovation. In 1970, you spend a shit ton of money and you got a shoebox. And 40 years later, you had to spend as much money as you had spent on the original. I think this is really the idea that maybe it's difficult to compare whether architecture today is cheaper because, you know, architects still spend a lot of money on all kinds of fancy nonsense in order to make those buildings happen. But it's definitely high time preference. It's definitely built for, looking good today and looking nice today as opposed to looking great in the future. Not just looking great, but surviving and operating properly into the future.
Yeah, I mean, this is the part of the book that really blew me away the most and really made me reflect on it the deepest, just around how these institutions are getting hollowed out. I mean, I love the way you kind of frame up or sum up the impact on the family. And, you know, maybe the government can provide for you in the future, but they're not going to love you in the future and love and sort of these other things are just as important or more important than someone providing for you or the government providing for you, and how they're taking over, so many facets of our lives. And it's such high time preference across fiat food, fiat education, fiat science, fiat energy. And this is when I felt like the knives did come out a little bit and Safe kind of was like, this is how I really feel. Having written these two books, and back to back, are you optimistic coming out of this experience? Can Bitcoin fix society? Can we make civilization great again?
You know, I mean, the beginning of the writing of the book, the process of writing the book initially was hugely optimistic, and some would say delusionally optimistic. And delusional optimism is one of my personal traits. Unquestionably, I'm a Liverpool fan who spent 30 years believing we're going to win the league every year, and we never won it, but we did win it at the 30th try. But it was basically 30 years of me thinking this is going to be our year. So delusional optimism is definitely a personality trait when it comes to me. And initially when I was writing this book, you know, I think there was the idea that Bitcoin fixes this, definitely. And also, Bitcoin fixes this in an almost painless way. Because, and this is the topic of the third part, the really interesting aspect of how Bitcoin fixes this is that if fiat is a big giant house of cards where you have fake money and fake debt bundled upon fake money and fake debt, Bitcoin fixes this because it undoes the fake house of cards. And the argument I make is It doesn't necessarily have to lead to a massive collapse in economic institutions, as most people expect, because Bitcoin does not just reduce the demand for fiat, it also reduces the supply of fiat. Because in a fiat world, everybody wants to borrow, but as people start to realize they can just hold on to hard assets, well, there's much less need to borrow now. And there's much less need to lend. So instead of people buying bonds, they'll buy Bitcoin. And instead of people borrowing, they'll spend from their savings. And so there'll be a decline in demand for Bitcoin, a decline in demand for fiat, but there'll also be a decline in the supply of fiat and the creation, because there's a decline in lending. So that's kind of the root of the optimism, of why I would think that maybe this can just be a peaceful, happy upgrade where, and I still think this is possible because, you know, fiat is built to devalue, and the devaluation of fiat is not that catastrophic. Well, I mean, of course, it is catastrophic for the world's poor, but it has always been catastrophic for the world's poor. But it's not as catastrophic for the world's powerful people, because that's what the game is. The majority of people in the world who have wealth and who have any power, they are in debt. And so the devaluation of fiat for them is the devaluation of their liabilities, which is a good thing. You know, in the example of hyperinflation in Lebanon, if you had a loan for a house that was worth $1 million, you now owe the bank $50,000. You have $1 million house and you only owe $50,000 for it, because the loan was denominated in the local currency and the local currency has lost 95% of its value. And so you only owe about 5% of the value. So as the devaluation of the fiat continues, you know, the people in power are going to enjoy this process, and they're going to upgrade to Bitcoin and accumulate more and more Bitcoin. And basically, fiat just drifts into irrelevance. That's why I think Bitcoin is a neat technical solution, because it provides us with a hard monetary asset that we can monetize rather than monetizing debt. And so it devalues debt and it obsoletes the debt-based monetary system, and it shrinks it, and it just generates a bigger, more powerful, better monetary system. And it's almost like, you know, the typewriter economy just withers away and goes to zero. There was not a calamitous collapse of typewriter industry. We didn't have a crisis when the typewriter factories went out of business. They just continued to wither away and get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And now we don't have any more typewriters, but nobody cares because everybody's upgraded to computers and word processors and printers. So that was really kind of the happy ending of the book. But I started writing the book in 2018, you know, back in La Belle Époque, the golden age of fiat, if you want, when, you know, things were normal and people could leave their house and live mm-hmm. like human beings. But as I was writing this book, I think the emergence of central bank digital currencies and the way in which we saw the world unfold during the coronavirus crisis suggests that perhaps things are going to be trickier, because we're seeing that central banks and governments have just upped the ante of their everything that they do. I mean, you know, the things that I would have been writing about in 2018, you know, me writing this stuff in 2018 might have sounded a little extreme, but now nobody can really deny all of this insanity that's going on and the enormous amount of power that governments have. And now we see with, you know, we see that how this vaccine issue is going to be used to make passports, movement passports. And now that's going to be on your phone, and that's going to be linked to your central bank digital currency. And now you're going to have complete totalitarian control of your movements, similar to the Chinese social credit score system. And, you know, I think this A is going to make things ugly. It's going to make economic, it's going to have a terrible economic impact, because, you know, flourishing and freedom come from flourishing and economic production and prosperity come from freedom, not from control. So A, but B, I think perhaps more significantly to the central thesis of the book, is that as central banks move towards central bank digital currencies, with UBI and with money becoming, and with essentially the banking system disintermediated, we go away from fiat as being credit money and we go back to fiat as being basically printed money, but now it's digital. So central bank, when you look at a case of an inflation, hyperinflation that happens, inflation, as long as the monetary system, as long as they don't get into the ugly phase of actually running the printers like crazy, inflation remains manageable because the credit system is self-correcting in a sense. So no matter if you issue a lot of credit, you're going to create the business cycle. So you're going to create an increase in the money supply, you're going to create some inflation, but then you're issuing a lot of credit. A lot of companies have a lot of credit, they fail, and the price comes crashing down. And sorry, the sector in which that credit is invested comes crashing down, and then that credit is wiped out. You get a lot of defaults and bankruptcies, and you get a deflationary crash that kind of restricts the inflation. This is kind of the equivalent of the difficulty adjustment in the fiat system, that credit expands but contracts, expands and contracts. And it is inflationary overall. We're increasing at 5, 6, 7, 8% per year in the kind of advanced economies. And it can go up to 10, 20, 30, or something like that in the more advanced economies. But in order to get to Zimbabwe and Venezuela and Lebanon territory, there has to be a physical printer involved because that physical money gets printed and it stays printed. It doesn't collapse, it doesn't go away. It's just an increase in the money supply. So what central bank digital currencies are doing are essentially bringing the inflation of the digital of the printing press to the digital realm. It's going to allow for the creation of money that just gets handed out to people, and it's just going to mean more and more inflation and fewer business cycles. That's the thing. You're going to see more inflation and fewer business cycles because it's credit money that causes the business cycle, according to Austrian theory. But just printing out money and handing it out causes price inflation. So that, I think, kind of puts a dent in the theory. In the central theory of the book. And I say this in the end, I think like initially the point before coronavirus and all of this stuff, the ending would have been, and here's how Bitcoin fixes this peacefully and happily. And Bitcoin is allows us to just basically, instead of the house of cards collapsing, we can just take the cards apart one at a time by removing the demand and the supply, and we live happily ever after. But now I think, it's less likely that we get this happy ending, and I think it's going to get ugly before it gets better, and unfortunately.
Wow. A lot to unpack there, but I just only have a couple more, two more questions for you just to wrap up. I do think that maybe for typewriters and fax machines, maybe Paul Krugman might be upset about those. And I bring that up because maybe when I was growing up, he was an intellectual that people would look up to. And I believe more in ideas, not looking up to ideas or being captured by ideas, not men. But I'm glad that you're out here putting out these ideas. I think they're incredibly important, and they speak truth to power in a lot of ways. So my two more questions for you is, how has fiat changed you? We always ask how
Fiat?
bit, yeah, has fiat changed you?
Well, fiat, I mean, it wasn't as much changed me. I was born into it, and I'm third generation fiat, basically. So I come from a long line of people damaged by fiat, as all of my generation does. So
Fair enough.
yeah, in a sense, I think it's I think if you look at people in our generation, we don't have a concept of saving money. It's very rare to find people who save unless they get into Bitcoin. And you just spend everything that you have. And even when you think of investing is more like gambling than it is a kind of responsible financial decision. I used to eat fiat food. I used to eat the garbage that is promoted by governments. And I was Fiat Saif al-Din is a very different person from the person you see in front of you today.
And my final question is, has Bitcoin changed you? I mean, you seemed really primed for Bitcoin, and you seemed aware of a lot of what was happening to us externally because of fiat. Has Bitcoin changed you in any ways?
I mean, yeah, for sure. It's lowered my time preference, and it's made me aware of all of these things. It's I got married because of Bitcoin. Well, not because of Bitcoin, but like I met my wife around the same time that I started really paying attention to Bitcoin. And I think it's just that mindset shift of realizing, once you realize that, yeah, Bitcoin can work and it really is the Cinderella that fits into the slipper, then suddenly the future becomes something that you can think about. And it was pretty transformative for me that I snapped out of just your average 20-something, 30-something modern existence of doing stupid, inconsequential bullshit every day for short-term pleasure. And you snap out of it and you start thinking, yep, yeah, let's think about the future. Let's think about the long term. What am I doing for myself 20 years from now? Where do I see myself 20 years from now, 30 years from now? And what am I doing today to provide for me 20, 30 years from now? And it's just, once you start thinking in that way, everything changes.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on finding the glass slipper in Bitcoin, but also more importantly, in love, life, and family. That's really beautiful. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, Saif. It's been an immense honor and really privileged to have this experience with you. And if you could just let people know where they could find you and how they can get a copy of the book. It really is a tour de force.
Thank you, sir. The Fiat Standard now, it's, I mean, printing and shipping and all of that stuff is pretty complicated these days, but you can pretty much get it on my website, wherever you are in the world. So just go to saifuddin.com and order the book. We are just beginning to work on, we're shipping this week all over the world. You might also find it in your local Amazon, and in the next couple of months it'll become more and more available in Amazon and all other major booksellers, I hope.
Yeah, man, thank you so much. This has been so dope.
Fantastic, thank you so much. Take care.
Saif Eddin Amous on the fiat standard versus the Bitcoin standard and delusional optimism right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This special episode was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 Conference. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation, raising the bar in the space, and they have the best interest rates. To get going, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan. Remember, prices for the Bitcoin 2022 conference are going up in 1 week, so get in now and get 10% off your tickets by using our code BitcoinMatrix at checkout. And thank you for listening. Please support our sponsors, subscribe, rate, and review the Bitcoin Matrix podcast so you don't miss out on any upcoming fresh and dope episodes. We have Vijay Boyapati, Ed Lattimore, Compass Mining, Rob Hamilton, so many more booked. Stack Sats, stay humble, get out of the fiat matrix, and enter the Bitcoin Matrix. This is said. Peace.